All right, we'll get started. Okay, so first off, your assignments are due today by the end of class. If you have them on paper, you can bring them and drop them off during the break or at the end of class. If you're going to slip with assignment one, then put it in my mailbox by the due date. I forget what I said, but it's written on the assignment description. Definitely not that. But yeah, it's fine. Okay, the other sort of logistical point is next week the midterm is going to be written. So it'll be written in class. So you'll come to class, you'll write the midterm. What do you want to know about it? So the questions I haven't written yet, so I couldn't tell you even if I wanted to. Sure. So you can bring one piece of paper, one-sided, anything you want written on it.
One-sided?
One-sided just because it's more just a logistical thing because if people are flipping their sheet back and forth, it's loud for everyone. So, letter size, so normal size paper. But you can write it as small as you want. You can write it in four-point font and bring a magnifying glass, whatever, as long as it's not loud. Yeah. No, it can be typed or handwritten, whatever you want. Yeah. Any restriction on what's on it? No, you can write whatever you want on it. Yeah, so if you want a copy of last year's midterm, you can put last year's midterm. If you want to put a copy of the lecture notes on it, you'll have trouble fitting them, but you can do that. Just one-sided because I don't want people flipping. That's the main thing. And for the final, you'll get the same. So why do I do this? Well, A, people go to the bathroom and they check their phones. So whatever you're checking on your phone, you can put on your piece of paper. So you don't have to do that. So that's the first reason. Second reason is in real life, you're going to go get a job. It's not like you're going to not have a crypto textbook on your shelf if you want it, right? Being able to apply cryptographic techniques, it does not mean that you have everything in your head memorized, okay? So the exam is going to be the types of questions I'm going to ask are not going to be questions that you can answer by looking something up in the notes, okay? They're not going to be memorization. So it's going to be like the assignment. Now, the assignment is tough, okay? It's meant to, go away for a day and think about, okay? So that's not fair for an exam situation. But it's going to be like the assignment in the sense that the answer is not in the notes. It's a new situation. It's applying something from the notes in a new situation, and you have to understand what that thing is that's being applied. And if you understand the properties, then you can answer the question, okay? And if you don't remember the properties, they're on your sheet, okay? But you do have to actually sort of understand the properties to be able to apply it, okay? Midterms, I think last year, probably the last 2-3 years, there's some midterms online, so you can go looking at previous year's lectures. Let's see. And the structure of the midterm, let me go through it because I did something last year that I liked, so I think I'll do it again this year. So the midterm you can find and the solutions you can find as well. And if you want, I do take the midterm up in class. So you can, if you're confused about it, because I just write down some scribbles or whatever, if you find, I guess it's this lecture, if you listen to the audio, somewhere in that audio, there's the actual taking up of the midterm. Questions are going to be completely different, right? I'm not going to ask the same questions. So don't study the midterm because that's stupid, right? Study the notes, study the concepts. But once you know the concepts and you want to see and sort of test yourself, then you could use last year's midterm or the year before as just sort of a gauge to see that you're understanding things correctly. But anyways, last year there was only 4 questions, which I liked. It was easy to mark. I'll probably do something similar, 4 or 5. And you can see there's 2 variants of each question, and that's because we have a small room, and so the person sitting beside you, we probably can't get a seat in between everyone. So I've done different things different years. Some years I have half the class write it, leave, and then the other half comes in. And this time what I did is you sort of write down your student number, and then depending on what it is, you're either going to answer A or B. And the 2 questions are meant to be sort of the same. They're different enough that if you copy your neighbors, it's going to give you the wrong answer. But they're close enough that you can't really say that they had an easier exam question than you did because their student number was different. Okay, so they're essentially the same. The essence of the question is the same, but the details themselves are different. Okay, and so anyways, if you see something like that this year, don't be surprised. So basically, you'll write down your student number, and then if it's even or odd, you'll answer either the first one or the second one. So everyone will write a slightly different version of the exam. So the criteria changes for each question. So you might write the first question of the first page and then the second question of the second page, second question of the third page, or whatever, depending on what your student number is. Okay? So anyways, any questions about that aspect? No? Okay. So the questions will be conceptual. It's not going to be something that you can memorize. Really focus on the notes. If you understand the notes, you should be fine. Shouldn't be a problem. If you're just sort of memorizing the notes or you can repeat things back from the notes, that's not going to help you. You will have to actually understand the primitives and stuff that are involved. Any other questions about it? You can bring a calculator if you want. Probably don't need it. Maybe some years there's an entropy question. I try and choose the numbers nice so that you don't need to solve it. And another thing too is you don't always, if you don't have a calculator, you need to solve something, you don't have to take it all the way down to that number at the very end. You can leave it in terms of like it's the log 2 of 36. I don't know what the log 2 of 36 is. And that's fine. I'll accept that as an answer. But in general, I don't try to ask questions that require a calculator. Your calculator can be non-programming only, which shouldn't be an issue because you have a cheat sheet anyways. Other questions? You'll have the full class, so there'll be no lecture. 4 questions, it shouldn't take you the full class, but there's always students that stay till the end. Don't be that student. No, it's perfectly fine. Okay, other questions? No, today's material will be covered on the exam as well. Another common question. Okay, if you think of anything else you want to ask, you can ask me later. Okay, is there any questions from last week before we jump in? Okay, so last week we were talking about block ciphers. So it's been a while since, it was actually 2 weeks ago. So let's just remind ourselves what's going on. So we have Alice. And we have Bob. Alice and Bob both have a key. It's the same key. How they ended up with the same key, we're not sure. They met in an alley. We'll solve that problem later in the class. Okay? And Alice also has a message. Okay? So she has a message. She wants to send it to Bob. So what she's going to do is she's going to use an encryption function. It's going to take her key, and it's going to spit out a ciphertext. She'll send the ciphertext across the wire. Bob will use the decryption function, which takes the same key. He will decrypt it and recover the original message. Okay? And so what we're concerned about is what does this thing look like? Okay? Now, we know one way of doing it, which is a stream cipher. Well, we know two. There's a one-time pad. One-time pads aren't great because the keys are huge. We know a stream cipher. A stream cipher has a small key. So it's 112 bits or 128 bits, and the ciphertext and the message will be the same length. Okay, so that's one way of doing it. What we started looking at last class is a block cipher. So block ciphers are an alternative way of doing it. And in a block cipher, you basically have... So at the highest level, it looks exactly the same. Both stream ciphers and block ciphers look like this. So we have a key. It's the same key for both. It's going to be greater than 112 bits. Okay, because we wanted to resist exhaustive search attacks. We have a message, and we have a ciphertext. Okay, now, in a block cipher, what we're going to do is we're going to encrypt a block at a time. Okay, and so a block cipher only takes, by definition, it takes one block of message. So it's not... infinite. Okay, so it's going to take exactly, and it depends on the block cipher, but a common amount might be like 128. Okay, and then therefore your ciphertext will come out at the same size. Keys, sorry, should be greater than or equal to 112, the size of K. Yeah. Reverse that. Thank you. Okay. Okay, so this is what happens. Okay, so a block cipher does that. Common block ciphers, AES, we'll talk about other ones, but if you want to think in concrete terms, that's the name of a block cipher, and we'll look at it much later in the course. Okay, now the second thing we want to do is we want it to be like a stream cipher. With the stream cipher, you can encrypt any size message, and you get the same size ciphertext. So if you want to encrypt 8 gigs, you can encrypt 8 gigs, okay? The fact that you can only encrypt 128 bits isn't great, okay? So what we're going to do is we're going to kind of chain calls to this encryption function together so that we can support an infinite number of bits, okay? So what we'll have is we'll have a block cipher plus what we might call a mode of operation. And so a mode of operation just means how you're chaining calls together. Okay? And so we can think also in terms of something like this. So I'll put MOO, which is kind of a funny acronym, but that means mode of operation. In fact, let me write it slightly different. All right, so we have a mode of operation, encryption mode of operation. Still takes a key and a message, and it returns you ciphertext, and then similarly, the decryption has to know what the mode of operation was that was used. Okay, and the big benefit here is we can now encrypt any size input that we want. And we'll get the same size output. So the size of C will equal the size of M. Okay, this is generally true. Just like in hashing, if our message doesn't fill up an entire block, so we're going to do it block by block, so there might be some padding. So the message might be slightly smaller than the ciphertext because the ciphertext pads out the last message, but this is the way we'll think of it for now. It's close enough to being correct. Okay, so that's the mode of operation. Yeah. Say that again, sorry. So the length of K is independent of the message and the ciphertext. So the message and ciphertext will always have the same length, and K will have a length as well. And so K will be 112 bits, at least, according to NIST. In practice, it's going to be a value like 128. So if you look at AES 128, the key is going to be 128 bits, and M and C will also be 128 bits. So the block size will be the same. But if you go up to AES 256, your key is going to be 256 bits, but your block size will still be 128. Yeah. So you can think of them as independent from each other. It doesn't matter. And there's no real security consideration with how big the block is. Yeah. And so you can think, if you want to think really theoretically, you can think of a stream cipher as a block cipher. It's just a block cipher where the block size is one bit. That's like an okay way of thinking. Yeah.
Is the mode of operation a secret or is it published?
So it's published. Yeah. So what's the secret in this case? So your encryption function's published, AES. Decryption's published, AES. And then your mode of operation will also be published. And you'll negotiate that. So instead of saying, I'm going to send you a message with AES, if I send you a message with AES, that just tells me that that's the encryption function that's going to be used. So what I have to say is I'm going to do AES in ECB mode or CBC mode. So these are the names of common modes of operations.
If the mode of operations is secret, what's the use of having the mode of operations?
Exactly. Good question. So we'll come back to it. So there's no... Yeah, in terms of the secrecy, okay. So it turns out the security level will differ. So we'll motivate this as we go through. So hang on to your question. You'll know the answer when we actually start seeing the modes of operation. Yeah. Sort of, yeah, yeah. So you're taking a block of the message at a time. Yep, so hopefully our mode of operation won't have that problem. Okay, so it turns out it doesn't have that exact problem, but it has similar kinds of malleability problems. Yeah. And so as we go through these, we'll fix them. Okay, so common modes of operation, ones that we'll look at are ECB, CBC, and we'll define what these mean. This is electronic codebook, cipher block chaining, counter mode, and then there's something called GCM, Galois counter mode. Okay, and it turns out that these all have different levels of security. So this is the weakest. This one has a sort of medium level of security, and this has the highest level of security. And we're about to define what that is. So this we call OTS. One-time secure, this we call chosen plaintext attack secure, and this we call CCA, chosen ciphertext attack secure. Okay, but you don't know what any of this stuff means, it's just acronyms, but this is sort of a roadmap of where we're going. Okay? Okay, any questions about this so far? Okay. So what I want to do is, yeah, go ahead. No PRGs here. So we don't know what this algorithm is yet. Oh, sorry. How do we generate the key? Yes. Yeah, so your computer will generate it from its entropy pool, run it through an extractor, and then it could run it through a PRG, and then that's how you would generate the key. Yeah. For the key itself, yeah. Yeah. Or you can flip coins. I don't know. Encryption doesn't care how you get the key, but it does care that it's random. So, yeah. But in practice, that's what happens, is it goes through the extractor and then through the PRG. Other questions? Okay. Okay. So let's think about what security means for encryption in general, including block ciphers or stream ciphers, both. But we'll think of it in terms of block ciphers, since that's what we're talking about. So we'll be informal, and then we'll formalize it. Okay, so the first thing we have is the setup. I'll sort of draw it in. So we're assuming that we kind of have an adversary. So the adversary is sitting on the wire. And so what does the adversary know? Well, they see C, okay? We'll assume that they know what encryption function's being used. They know it's AES. They know the mode of operation. They know everything. The only thing they don't know is K, okay? And at a highest level, what we want to do is we want them not to be able to decrypt C and recover M. Okay, so we need a security property that essentially says if you don't know K, then you can't figure out how to decrypt things. Okay, so that's sort of what we have here. And this is if and only if. Okay, in other words, it's irreversible if you don't know the key. So we could write that as a second property. What about the key itself? Well, if knowing the key allows you to decrypt, then you shouldn't be able to find the key, okay? So one thing you could do is you could try every key possible. So you could encrypt this. You could run decryption with K set to 0. Then you could set it to 1. You could set it to 2. You could set it to 3. And eventually, you'll hit the right value of K. And when you hit the right value of K, then all of a sudden, English is going to come out instead of garbage. So if you try to decrypt something with the wrong key, we'll try and capture that property next. you'll get sort of random looking noise, okay? But when you hit the right key, then, you know, something will come out, it'll look sensible, and then you'll be like, okay, I decrypted it, okay? So what stops us from trying every key? Well, we make the key big, okay? So big that you can't try every key, okay? So if we make the key at least 112 bits, how many possible keys are there? There's 2 to the 112 possible keys. We know you can't try that number of keys, okay? That's infeasible, it's computationally infeasible, according to NIST. So if we try and do an exhaustive search of the key, it's too big. Okay, the final thing that BlockCypher has is something we call the avalanche effect. And so this applies to both encryption and decryption. But basically it says, if you change one bit of the input, then the whole output changes in a kind of random way. Okay, so if you encrypt the same message twice under the same key, and they're not exactly the same message, they're all the same message except for one bit somewhere is different, the output will be completely different. Okay, it'll just look like completely different random numbers, okay? Similarly, if you're trying to decrypt something and you're guessing the key, say you get really close, you have the key, it's almost entirely correct, but one bit is wrong, you're just going to see garbage as a result, okay? Or if a ciphertext is going across the wire and say one bit of it flips, and then you try and decrypt it, you're just going to get garbage as a result as well, okay? So everything has to be exactly correct down to the bit in order to get the right output that you're expecting. Otherwise, you can expect a random looking output or an output that you can't tell the difference between it and a random number. So we're going to use this property a lot when we consider different modes of operation.
Changes of bit, should be from the key or the
value? Yeah, so by input, I mean either. So technically, encryption has two inputs. I tend to write it as a subscript, but if you prefer, you can think of it as the encryption of K and M. So either input. Yeah. And similarly with C, it takes K as an input. Okay, now what we want is we want a more formal definition of security. So these are some ideas of what security means, but they're not very strict or they're not very formal in terms of different things. Okay, so that's our goal. So let me motivate it with an example. Let's say that, for example, encryption goes across the wire, and I can't decrypt it, but maybe I can decrypt one bit of it. So I can tell whether the first bit of the message is a 0 or 1 just by looking at the ciphertext itself. Is that a break of the encryption scheme or not? Well, from our informal properties, we sort of say, you can't reverse encryption. Well, I didn't really reverse it, right? I didn't fully reverse it anyway. I kind of partially reversed it, right? So should that count as secure or should it not count as secure, okay? So that's the idea of formalization. Formalization is going to lay down really strict lines in the sand in terms of this is possible or this isn't possible, okay? And what we're going to do is we're going to be as sort of restrictive as possible in terms of what the adversary can do. So if it leaks even one bit of the message, we're going to say not secure. Okay? If when you look at the ciphertext, if maybe you don't even know what that one bit is, but instead of it being a 50-50 guess, you're like kind of 60% sure it's a one as opposed to 40% it's a zero, we want that to fail too. Okay? So we want like very, very strict security where when you look at the ciphertext and you look at, say, a random number, like they should be as useful as each other. Okay? Looking at ciphertext should be no more useful to you trying to break the encryption than just looking at a random number. Okay? That's essentially what we want to capture in terms of our security definition. Okay? Security definitions look kind of weird. There's more than one way of doing it. Okay? So there's lots of ways that you could write down security definitions. There's a lot of ways, like if you read the cryptographic literature, papers, textbooks, and stuff like that, there's different ways. But there's one way that was influential, not because it was the best way, it was just the first way. Okay? So someone back in the 80s, they said, here's a nice definition of security, and everyone sort of agreed that even though it's maybe not the most intuitive definition, it works. Okay? You can actually go out and prove like things are secure or not secure using this definition. Okay? So the way it looks is sort of happenstance. Okay? It doesn't have to look the way it looks. It just looks that way for historical reasons. Okay? So how they structure it is they structure security in terms of a game that's going to be played. Okay? So we sometimes call it a security game. Okay, so we're going to have two players in the game. There's going to be an attacker or an adversary. Okay, and there's going to be, you're tempted to sort of call them a defender. They're not really a defender. There's a very unhelpful word that the crypto literature uses. They call it an oracle. Okay, so this is a game between an adversary and an oracle. Okay, and the way the game works is not exactly the game I'm about to show you, but this is just sort of a first attempt at coming up at a game. Okay, so we're going to have this little interaction between the oracle and the adversary. Okay, so what the oracle might do is they'll choose a key. And maybe I'll say a few more words about it. You can think of it this way. Think of it like say I come to you and I say, you know what, I know how to break AES, right? And I'm not going to tell you how I'm breaking it. I just want to kind of prove to you that I can break it, okay? So then what you might do is you might say, okay, let's play a little game. So you might like encrypt a message, send it to me, and then say, okay, if you know how to break AES, then decrypt it. And then if I can decrypt it, then you'll say, okay, you know how to break it, otherwise you can't. Okay? That's the idea of this game. So the oracle is kind of like the challenger. They're kind of sending challenges to the adversary to test whether the adversary can actually break it or not. Okay? So I'll put challenger here besides oracle. Okay, so if I wanted to run this game, let's just write down what I just said. So what would I actually do? I would choose a key at random. Okay, that's my encryption key. And then I would choose a message. So this is K. This is M. Then I would send C equals the encryption of the message under K. Okay. You would say, here's what I think the message is. Okay, so you would guess M. Using whatever attack it is. Okay, so you have some attack. I don't know what it is, but you say this is what the message is. And then I, you know, if it's right, if your asserted message actually is the message that I sent, then I say success. And if it's different, then I say fail. Okay, so we could start it with this as our little game. Okay, and we could say an encryption scheme is secure if you can't win this game. Okay, so let me write that. So the definition would be and I'll say any adversary, so using any strategy. Okay. Now we're still being a little sloppy and a little informal. So one thing we know is that if the adversary has unlimited computational power, they can brute force the key. Okay, they can try every value of the key. Eventually, they'll find one that returns something sensible, so they will win. So we can't really say any adversary, okay? We're going to have to say any adversary that's sort of like a normal computer, right? Something that can't do infeasible things like exhaustively search 2 to the 112, okay? So what we'll say here is we're going to say computationally bounded, or sometimes they use a fancy term, PPT bounded, which means probabilistic polynomial time bounded. But we'll just say computationally bounded. Okay? And then the other thing we didn't really define is what does it mean to win the game? Does that mean you succeed all the time, 100% success rate? What if your success rate's 1%? Do you win or not? Okay? So you have to succeed. If you always fail, it's clear you're not winning the game. But like, how often do you have to succeed? Okay, so these are two sloppy bits that we'll take care of. Well, we took care of the one, and then this one we'll take care of in a second. Okay, now, why is this a first attempt and not the final definition? Well, let's go back to what I said before. What if it leaks the first bit? So if I look at the ciphertext and I say, oh, I know the first bit of this message, but I don't know the rest of it. Or let's say I know all of it, but I don't, you know, I'm missing like the last 5 bits or something like that, okay? We would say that's not a good encryption scheme, right? If you can decrypt most 90% of the ciphertext and not the last 10%, it's not good, okay? But I can't win this game because this game requires me to say the exact message itself, okay? So even though I can break 90% of it, if I have to break 100%, okay, in order to win the game, because I can't win the encryption scheme is secure. So an encryption scheme that's only like sort of 10% secure is secure under this definition. So it's a bad definition. Okay, we need a stronger definition. Does that make sense? Okay. So the only things that are insecure are ones that leak all of the message, okay? If it only leaks part of it, then it could fit under the security definition, okay? So we would go around mislabeling things as secure even though they're not actually secure, okay? So what we need is we need a higher bar. We need a definition that's harder, it's harder for your encryption scheme to be considered secure, okay? So what we're going to do is we're going to tweak the game slightly. Does anyone have any idea how we could tweak it to capture this idea that even if you knew, like, say, one bit of the message or you knew something about the message that it wouldn't qualify as secure?
Say, you stated to be that given any message M, the
Okay. So why 50-50?
Well, because the idea is that you, even if you encrypt just one bit, you want it to be as secure as, secure as possible, which means that you actually have it.
Okay. So there's good ideas in there. It's not exactly what we're going for. You could define, so we did define one-time secure, one-time pads using that entropy approach. A consequence of the security definition that we'll come up with is that that will hold. So the conditional probability of seeing the ciphertext or not seeing the ciphertext will be the same. But what I like from your idea is that, okay, so you say, like, it doesn't matter. First off, what you say is true. If you encrypt one bit or another bit, it should be as secure as each other. Okay, so that's the idea we're going to play with. What we're going to do is we're going to let the adversary choose two messages, okay? And they can choose them any way they want, okay? The only rule is they can't be the same, okay? And what the oracle is going to do is they're going to encrypt one of them, okay? So it might choose A, it might choose B, it'll flip a coin, okay? And it will send the ciphertext. And then what the adversary is going to do is they just have to say whether it was the first one or the second one, okay? And so if, for example, let's say they can break it because it leaks one bit of information, the first bit, then they'll make two messages that are exactly the same except for the first bit will be different. One will be a 0, one will be a 1, okay? So by giving the adversary control over the two messages, whatever algorithm that they have, they can arrange those two messages such that they can exploit that property, okay? Let's write it down and then we'll... so we can look at it while we talk about it. Okay, so this is called the OTS game, or one-time secure game. And this is the basic approach to how we're going to consider security. It doesn't even strictly matter. They could choose them to be the same. You'll see that they just sort of shoot themselves in the foot if they do that. So they're going to send M1, M2 to the Oracle. Now, what the Oracle is going to do, whether it's before or after receiving the messages, it doesn't matter. They'll choose their key. Okay. Then they're going to receive these two messages. Okay. And what they're going to do is they're going to flip a coin. We'll denote as B for a bit. So sometimes we use this element subscript R to denote random choice. So that just means choose randomly between 0 and 1. So we choose this bit at random. Okay. And then what we're going to do is we're going to encrypt whichever message we chose. So we'll call it CB equals the encryption under K of MB, where B subscript B is either. So let me change this to 0 or 1 just so that we don't keep the notation easier to follow. Okay. So we're going to take MB, so either M0 or M1, and that's CB that we're going to send back. And then what the adversary is going to do is they're going to guess whether they're either going to say B prime equals 0 or B prime equals 1. They'll send that guess. I say guess. It doesn't have to be a guess. It's an educated guess, right? Because they have some algorithm that's going to tell them. And then if they're correct, B equals B prime, then we output success. And if it's not equal, then we fail. Okay, why is this game better than the other game? Okay, first off, anything that passes the first game, if you literally can't decrypt anything about the message, then it's obvious that it's going to pass this game, right? you'll just choose any two messages. You're going to get back a ciphertext. You won't be able to decrypt any of it, okay? And because you can't decrypt any of it, then you're not going to succeed a lot, okay? So we should also, so let me go there first. So let's write down the actual definition. So we'll borrow this idea. So we'll say the encryption scheme is OTS secure. If no computationally bounded adversary can win the OTS game, just leave it. Okay, so I'm not finished this definition, but let's just leave this. Okay, just trying to fit the whole thing. Okay, what's the probability that if you don't have any ability to decrypt, that you'll win this game? Okay, so what are you going to do? So here you're supposed to choose either 0 or 1. You don't know which of the two it is. Okay, you have no information that tells you. So what are you going to do? You're just going to guess, okay? Random guess, okay? What's the probability that your random guess is correct? A half, okay? So an adversary that knows nothing will still win this game half of the time, okay? So we can't say that it's secure if you never win this game, okay? You are going to win. You're going to win a lot, okay? Even if you don't know anything, you're going to win half of the time, okay? So in order to show that you can actually break this encryption scheme, you're going to have to win with some probability greater than a half, okay? Now, sometimes you're just going to get lucky. Maybe you win 5 times in a row just because you were randomly guessing 5 times in a row, okay? So there is a kind of luck factor as well. So we want to be a little careful. We don't want to write down you have to win it strictly greater than a half, because maybe you win the first two games, you've won 2 out of 2. That's 100% success rate, right? But it was just actual random guessing, okay? So what we want to say is we want to say something like, as you play this game over and over and over, lots and lots of times, the probability is going to converge to 1/2 very quickly, okay? You're never going to be a half plus a really large amount, okay? And if you ever are, then that shows that you actually have some information, okay? So the way we write it is a little weird, and it doesn't really matter. I'm just putting in for sort of technical ability, but we'll say you can't win the game with probability greater than So we'll say 1/2 plus epsilon, okay? And this epsilon is meant to capture this sort of fudge factor that you may get random. You may get lucky just by guessing at random, okay? So epsilon is what we call a negligible factor or probability. Well, we'll call it a function. And basically it says that, exactly, it takes the luck factor out, yeah. So if you play the game enough, epsilon approaches 0. Okay. So if you played it 1,000 times and you're at 50.001%, we're not going to say you won the game, because that is technically bigger than a half, okay? We're going to say, well, that's within the sort of variance. You're never going to get 50% on the nose, right? So that's all this epsilon thing means, okay? Otherwise, you can sort of ignore it, but it will show up in these proofs, okay? Okay, so let's go through the game again just so that we're really sure what it means, okay? So the adversary chooses two messages. So if I can decrypt a yes, like if I can just look at a ciphertext and know what the message is, doesn't matter, I can pick anything. Hello, world. I'll get back either an encryption of hello, an encryption of world, and then I'll decrypt it, and then I'm done. I'll know which one of it was. I'll actually win with 100% probability, okay? So that's one way I could break it. Let's say I could break the first character, okay? So I don't know whether it's encrypts hello, world, but I know that the first character, whatever it is, okay? So if I choose M0 and M1 as hello, world, then I get CB, and I decrypt the first bit. I know that it's, or the first character, in this case, 8 bits, I would know it's either an H or a W, and based on whether I see an H or a W, I'll know whether it was hello or world that was encrypted, then I can still win 100% of the time, right? Now, if I could only decrypt that first character and I encrypted hello and hi, right, then I'm going to get an H in both cases, okay? So that's why we let the adversary choose the messages so that they can always choose the messages in such a way that they can use their attack, whatever their attack happens to be, okay? Now, let's say that I can't decrypt the first character exactly, but 1/1000th of the time I can. So 1/1000th of the time I can tell whether it's an H or a W, and the other 999 times I have no idea, okay? So what I'll do is, when I can't tell, I'll guess. So my probability will be 1/2. And for the 1/1000th of a time that I do know, then I'll actually report the right number, okay? And so what that means is my probability is going to be close to half, but it's going to be slightly higher than a half. Is it going to be higher than epsilon? Yes, okay? Epsilon is like a smaller amount, okay? So even if I can only guess 1/1000th of the time, I'm going to be like a half plus 1/1000th, which won't go to zero, as we run the trials more and more, okay? I'll have that advantage or that sort of edge, and that edge will ride out the number of trials that we do. It won't disappear over time. It will always be maintained at that particular value, okay? So this is a very strict security definition where literally any piece of information that you have that you could break the encryption scheme with, you'll be able to win this game. Thus, we won't consider the encryption scheme secure. As message length as the same as.
So let's say you have two messages of different length.
Oh, yeah, sorry, yeah. Good question. Right. So what we'll get into is when we have the mode of operation, you will be able to encrypt two different messages of different lengths, okay? So far we haven't seen a mode of operation, but a trivial way to distinguish these two is you send like a 1-block M1 and a 5-block M2, then based on C, whether it's 1 block or 5 blocks, you can tell what the difference is, okay? So the restriction we can add, and we might as well add it in now, is that M1 and M2, or M0 and M1 have to be the same size. Yeah, so that's a good point. Yes. Yeah, so the Oracle, they know the messages, both of the messages and the key. So think of it, let's think of it as I'm breaking the encryption scheme and you don't believe me, right? So I'm going to say, okay, here's two messages, encrypt one or the other. And to make that decision, you're going to flip the coin. If you don't flip the coin, like say you always choose the first message, if I know that you always choose the first message, then I'll be able to guess all the time, even though I couldn't break the encryption scheme, just because I could predict your behavior. So we want to take that out of the equation. So that's why we make the Oracle flip a coin. Yeah. Okay, other questions? Okay, so this maybe looks, yeah, go ahead.
To succeed at this game, you need to succeed 50 50% plus epsilon times.
So you have to succeed 50% plus something greater than epsilon. Okay. So don't get hung up on epsilon. Epsilon's just taking care of that corner case that, you know, sometimes you get really lucky. Okay. So epsilon's just your luck factor. If you can succeed a half plus any real effect that's not based on luck, then you win the game. Yeah. Okay. And we call that your advantage. So the probability that you succeed minus one half is called your advantage. And so, yeah, you want to show that you have a real non-negligible advantage or a not luck-based advantage. Yeah. Okay. Any other questions? Okay, so this is kind of weird. It's kind of weird to think about security in this way, but I promise you it makes sense, okay? And hopefully it'll become clearer when we see some, like, examples of it. But the first time I saw this, too, I thought, like, it took me a few weeks, like, before I, like, really... It took me a long time to really appreciate why it looks exactly the way it looks. You know, so if it seems weird to you, don't worry about it. But you have 1 week to figure it out before the midterm. Okay. All right. So let's look at modes of operation. And so what we're going to do is we're going to kind of, I'm going to give you this security game. Then we're going to look at a mode of operation. And then I'm going to show you why this mode of operation either meets the security definition or it doesn't. And then we're going to tweak it. We'll tweak the game. We'll make it more strong. And then we'll have a stronger mode of operation. We'll kind of go back and forth between the two. Okay. And we'll build up stronger and stronger security definitions. Okay. So like I mentioned, this is the weakest definition. Okay. So there's two stronger variants we'll call CPA and CCA that allow you to, that are harder to meet. Okay. So we're going to develop these sort of in tandem of each other, okay? Another note I'll just have, I had it in the notes last year, which it's a nice note. Okay, so every time we play the game, the Oracle is going to go through the whole process, which includes choosing a new key, okay? So we'll never get to play the game more than once with the same key, okay? So that's why it's called one-time security. It's just because the key's only used once. And so this will be consequential in a minute. Okay, so now we're going to jump away from the definition. We'll look at modes of operation, and then we'll jump back and forth between them. Okay, so the first one we'll look at is called ECB. Okay, so let's remind ourselves of what's the problem. So the problem is we have this block cipher. And our block cipher can only take a fixed length input, okay, like 128 bits, okay, and it will give us a fixed length output. This is a block, okay? But the problem we have is the message we want to encrypt is way bigger than one block. So how are we going to use this little thing that only encrypts little blocks to encrypt this big thing? Okay. So what we have to do is we have to use the little thing more than once. Okay. So we're going to do it somehow. Okay. And so the easiest way of doing it is just take your message, split it up into blocks. Okay. And then just reapply this for every block. Okay. So we'll talk about Paddy in a sec. So there will be Paddy. Okay, got skewed. But anyways, so we have four blocks, whatever. So we just run it through the encryption function four times. We get four blocks, and then we can join them together at the end, and we can call this our ciphertext. Okay, so this is like the dead easiest way of chaining it together. Yeah. Great, great question. So what do you think? Yes, so that's the case, okay? So what's the big problem with this mode of operation? The big problem is, let's say you have a message that's like some block, 128 bits, and then it's repeated, and then it's repeated again. What you're going to do is that pattern is going to show up in the ciphertext, okay? It's going to get mapped to some random value here, but you'll see that exact same random value repeated, okay? That's going to be a huge problem, okay? So this is why ECB is not secure enough. Yeah, so we'll get there in a second. Now, in order to decrypt, you just do the same thing. You take your ciphertext, you split it into blocks, and you just run it through the decryption algorithm instead. I'm going to be lazy and just copy and paste this. Okay, so if we want to decrypt, this is C, and this is M, and all of these are decryption functions instead of encryption functions. Okay. Okay, so as was pointed out, if you have a message where you have some repetition in terms of the input blocks, okay, when you encrypt them, then you're going to see that same repetition in terms of ciphertext itself, okay? Okay, so why is this a problem? Well, first off, do we ever see that kind of repetition, like just in the real world, okay? And the answer is yes, there's actually a lot of natural cases. One might be an image. So an image will have a bunch of pixels, okay? And the pixels are usually divisible by 128, which is your block size, okay? So a block will encode more than one pixel, but it's going to encode, you know, some fixed size of pixels, depending on what your color depth is of the particular picture itself, okay? So either you have one pixel or you have maybe four pixels. But anyway, anytime you have that same pixel that's the same, when you encrypt it, it's going to get mapped to some completely random pixel, okay? You have no control over what it gets mapped to, but it's going to look exactly the same for all the other pixels that are the same. So for example, black will get mapped to some random color called green, but all the black pixels will be green, okay? And if you have something that's a certain shade of gray, it will get mapped to purple, but all the pixels that are that shade of gray will all be purple, okay? And that's usually enough to actually just see the image itself. So Wikipedia actually hopefully still has a nice example. So let's see if I can pull this up. I can't make it bigger. Anyway, this is the Linux Penguin. And this is the Linux Penguin encrypted in the CB mode. Okay? So what you can see is that the black pixels kind of get mapped to some weird kind of shade of gray, and there's some weird colors, but you can definitely see, like, that's a penguin, right? Okay, so that's ECB mode in action, not looking so good. What we'd rather have is something like this, right, where it just looks completely random, completely like garbage, okay? So this is CBC mode or counter mode or something like that, okay? So that's where we're going to go with this. Let me drop this into the notes. Okay, so how are we going to fix this? Okay, so it turns out that if we go back to our security definition, every time we invoke this encryption function, what ends up happening, so there's different ways of interpreting OTS, okay, but the common way of interpreting it is when we consider, first off, if we consider one block messages, it's absolutely secure, okay? This only happens when we have more than one block. Under one-time security, because we rekey the oracle every time, so every time we play the game, the oracle chooses a new key. For each of these encryptions, it's kind of like they're choosing a new key. So this problem doesn't emerge in the OTS definition. Okay. So what we want to do is we want to improve our definition so that, first off, people can choose messages that are longer than one block and use that same key to encrypt every single block in it, okay? Then maybe we can deal with this particular problem, okay? So let's come up with that game, and then I'll show you why formally ECB doesn't, how we can win that game against ECB mode, we can win that game if ECB mode is actually used, okay? Okay, so what we'd like to do is we'd like to extend the OTS game to include more than one encryption under the same key. Okay, so we're going to have a stronger definition, and we're going to call it CPA, which stands for a chosen plain text attack. Okay, and as a consequence, ECB mode is OTS secure. But ECB is not CPA secure. Okay, so here's the CPA game. Exactly the same setup as before. We'll try and keep as much of the game looking the same, and then we'll add a few new things to it. Okay, so the oracle is going to start the same way. They're going to choose a key. The adversary at some point in this game is going to choose two messages. and 0, 1. Such that M0 is not equal to M1, but the length of M0 is equal to the length of M1. Okay, so since we're doing more than one encryption, we have to care about length now as well. Okay, so those send M0 and M1. The oracle will flip a coin. B. It'll send back CB, okay, and the adversary will guess whether M0 or B is a 0 or 1. In other words, is CB an encryption of M0 or is it an encryption of M1? And then the oracle will report whether it was successful or not. Okay, now what we're going to do to strengthen the definition, to make it harder to achieve, is we want to give the adversary more power, okay? If we give the adversary more power, then it's harder to design an encryption scheme that's secure against a stronger adversary. Therefore, we're going to end up with a stronger encryption scheme, okay? So what we're going to do is we're going to let the adversary do some extra stuff besides this core element of the game. So far, this is OTS security, okay? But we're going to capture this idea that in practice, when we do things like ECB, the oracle is actually encrypting lots of messages with the same key, okay? It's not just one block, and then it resets its key, okay? So what we're going to do is we're going to let the adversary choose messages that it wants encrypted and receive encryptions of it, okay? So this is also meant to model the idea that if I leave my computer sitting around, say the key's in it, but there's no way for you to extract it because it's on a chip or something like that. One thing you could do is just type in messages and then get the ciphertext, right? So you could type in 100 different messages, get 100 different ciphertexts, and then you can try and do your attack on the scheme on that scheme using that data, okay? Using what we call known plaintext and known ciphertext pairs, okay? So what we want to do is we also want to secure our encryption scheme against that attack. It's sometimes called the lunchtime attack. And so CPA security is sometimes called lunchtime security for historical reasons, but we just call it CPA. Okay? So what we're going to let the adversary do is we're going to say they can send any message. We'll call them MI. Okay, and I want to be clear, it's a set of messages, and they can do it as long as they want. They are computationally bounded, so they can't send an infinite number, but they can send as many as they can. And for every message, they're going to receive CI, where CI is the encryption of MI under the same key that will be used in the actual challenge itself. So I didn't actually specify what CB is here, but I should put it in. Okay. And then what we're going to do is we're going to say, you can do this as often as you want. You can do it before you submit your challenge ciphertext. Okay, so these are the key two ciphertexts. This is like what we call the challenge ciphertext. Okay, and then let's say you see CB and you're like, oh, CB looks kind of like something I saw up here. I wish I could send some more messages to see if I see something similar to CB. What we'll do is we'll say, sure, go ahead. So even after you see CB, you can repeat this little procedure and you can send any message that you want. Okay, and receive any decryption that you want. Okay, so the new stuff here, let me just note it and then I'll take questions, is isn't working very well. I should have did it a different color, but anyways. Okay, so anyway, these are the only two new steps before and after. Okay, questions? In terms of which? No, I'm not sure exactly what you're saying. So there's no randomness, that's right, yeah. Yeah, positive. So there is an attack. So what is it exactly? You can pull it up. Great, great. Okay, so let's say that, for example, I have some encryption scheme like ECB, okay? And so I know that, you know, I'm going to send hello and world. Those are going to be my two challenge ciphertexts, okay? And if I just send hello and world and I get back CB, no idea what CB encrypts, okay? But what could I do in this case? Well, what I could do is I'm allowed to send any messages that I want here. So why don't I send hello? I'll get a ciphertext back. I'll send world, I'll get a ciphertext back. Okay? Then I'll come down here, I'll send hello world as my challenge ciphertext. And I'm going to get back either the first ciphertext or the second ciphertext. Okay? And once I and one of them's going to match, and then I'll know exactly which one was encrypted. Okay? So then I'll break this encryption scheme. Okay? So what's the lesson? Okay, so we're using the same key, we're using the same input, we get the same output. Okay, so what do we call that when same inputs give you the same outputs? Deterministic, okay? So it turns out a fact is that any deterministic encryption scheme will break under this scheme. No deterministic encryption scheme can ever be CPA secure because you can always do that exact attack where whatever your challenge message is, you, even clearer, you can think of it after. So you send hello world, you get back CB, then you send hello and see whether this matches CB or not. Okay, and then you're done. Say that again, I missed the first part. Yeah, so he can send as many here as he wants. With the caveat that he's computationally bounded, so he can't send an infinite number of messages. But yeah. Okay. So no deterministic scheme is going to satisfy this particular thing, including ECB, which is deterministic. Okay. So what we need, if we want to have any hope at solving this, is we're going to need a non-deterministic encryption scheme. So what does that mean? That means you encrypt the same message twice under the same key, you should get back different ciphertexts. Okay. So what we want to do is we want to design a mode of operation that's going to give us that property. Okay, so that's where we're going. But let's write a bit down, we'll take a break, and then I'll show you what that looks like. It's just, you can think of it as a break on CPA game for deterministic encryption. There's no like real name for it. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so fact, ECB is not CPA secure. Now, we didn't prove that it's OTS secure, so it's a lot harder to prove that things are something. You can read these proofs in the textbook if you really want. I'm not going to show you any of them for block ciphers. I'm not going to prove to you that something ever is. If I want to prove it's not something, I just have to give you one case where it breaks down. And if I give you that one case, then it's sufficient. So it's a lot easier to prove nots than things are. So in this class, just to keep it short, I'm only going to show you some not proofs. I'll show you some counterexamples that prove things aren't the way that they are. We will see an actual positive proof that something is CPA secure, but I'm going to show it later when we do the math-based crypto because it's easier to show than in terms of block ciphers itself. Okay, so ECB is not CPA secure, so the attack we can do is... the adversary can ask for encryption of either, so let's say they set m0 to some value, we'll call it a, and they set m1 to another value, b. Okay? So this is in the challenge phase. Okay, so m0 is a, m1 is b, they get back cb. Now they can ask for the encryption of anything they want. So what are they going to ask for? Well, they're going to ask for the encryption of A. Okay? So the adversary So they receive the encryption of A, we'll call it CA. And just so that we have the notation handy, I'll say here they receive the encryption of either A or B. And so we'll call that MB as we do, or sorry, CB as we do in the actual game itself. Where B is either 0 or 1. Okay, so they get CA, then they're going to compare it to CB, okay? So if CB equals CA, what does that tell us? That means the message CB that was an encryption of A, okay? So in that case, B equals what? B equals 0, okay? And if CB is not equal to CA, must have been the other one, so B equals 1. Okay. And in this case, we'll actually win 100% of the time. Okay. It's not even some fraction over 50%. It's like we'll always win this particular game itself. Okay. And then the second fact no deterministic. Encryption scheme is CPA secure. Okay. All right. So now what we need to do is we need to talk about a non-deterministic encryption function. Okay. So that's what we'll do next. But let's take a 10-minute break first, and then we'll look at that. So come back at 15:45. Okay, so what we want to do is we want to, we have this problem. We have ECB, it's not as secure as we want. And we also know that no deterministic encryption scheme is CPA secure either. Okay, so what we'd like to do is we'd like to change our mode of operation so that it actually is both non-deterministic, and we also want to take care of this sort of problem in ECB where if you encrypt the same block twice, we don't want you to have the same block as in output, okay, like in that image problem, okay? So what we can do is we can start with ECB, so we can just sort of pencil in ECB, and then we can think about how we change it. So I'll try and be less sloppy this time. So what we'll do is we'll take our first message block. Second block. Okay, so what we have is ECB mode, essentially now, okay? So let's do these problems one at a time. So the first problem that we didn't like about ECB is that if these two are the same, then these two are going to be the same as well, okay? So what we're going to do to try and kind of ruin that property is we're going to make this value not just dependent on this message block, but we're going to make it dependent on previous message blocks as well. So we're going to kind of chain them together, sort of the way that we did with Merkle Dam Guard. Okay? So specifically what we're going to do is we're going to take this value here, we'll make a copy of it, and we're going to mix it with the next message. We'll do an XOR, which is the same thing that we saw in a stream cipher. Okay? Why does this work? Well, because of the avalanche effect, the output of this thing, the number that's sitting here on this wire, it's going to look random. Okay? It's going to be a very randomish looking number. Okay? And so what we're doing is when we XOR a message with something that's random, the result is random, sort of like a ciphertext. Okay? Now, there is one caveat, which is that in this case, it's not a secret value. Okay? Because we know that the thing that got mixed with this value is, we know what that value actually is, because it's this first ciphertext block, okay? But other than that, it does sort of randomly mask this value, so you get a kind of random-looking thing that goes into this, okay? So if these two messages are the same, it's no longer the case that these two outputs will be the same, okay? So that takes care of that property for us. Okay? Now, the only problem that we have now is what do we do the first time around? So the very first block, we don't have a previous value to XOR, okay? So maybe the first time we just let it go through, okay? Let's say we just let it go through. Is this CPA secure? So it's not going to be CPA secure because it's still deterministic, right? This encrypted will always give you these same three blocks, okay? If these are exactly the same, like this is AAA, you won't get ZZZ, you'll get three different values here, but if you ask for the encryption of AAA again, you'll get the same whatever the output is, okay? So what we want is we want it to be non-deterministic. So what we want to do is we want to add some randomness to this process, okay? Sorry? Say it louder. Yeah, exactly. So what we could do is we have two general approaches. One thing is we could change this so it's kind of like a random factor, or like it has a like randomness built in. We don't like that. We like our encryption schemes to be deterministic. You can write them down, that kind of thing. Okay, and we're using AES. We don't want to change how AES works. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to pull in another input, okay, and it's going to be a random number. Okay, so we're going to pick a random number, and we're going to consider that as an input to our encryption function, okay? This random number we're going to call an IV, or initialization vector, okay? Just sort of a fancy name. We saw an IV before with hash functions. It's going to work a little different than in the hash functions, okay? And we're going to XOR it in, okay? Now, why is it different than in the hash function? Well, in the hash function, the IV was always the same. NIST chose this as a value. That value is always the same. If this is a constant that, you know, when AES was standardized, they said, okay, you want to do CBC mode, always use this value, then the whole thing's still deterministic, okay? So what we want is, where we're going with this is the sender, when they encrypt, they're going to choose it at random, okay? And if they come back tomorrow and they encrypt the same message, they're going to choose a different IV. So every time you encrypt a message, you start by choosing an IV at random, then you encrypt your message, okay? Next time you're going to encrypt something, you choose a different IV, right? You choose it at random, and then you encrypt it, okay? So if you ever encrypt the same message twice, you're going to end up with different IVs. What happens if you have different IVs? Well, the input here is going to be different, right? So even if this message is the same, the input here is different. A one-bit difference is enough for the avalanche effect. So this output's going to be completely different. Then you're going to feed something completely different all the way through. So this value here touches this value, which touches this value, which touches this value. So the idea is it's going to ripple all the way through, and you're not going to be able to do anything of consequence in terms of predicting things. Yeah. Agreed. Yeah. Okay. So first thing to note is this is a bitwise XOR. So that means IV has a size. Okay. So how big is it? So we'll call this bitwise XOR. So the IV is going to be the same size as your message block. Okay. So if your message block is 128 bits, then your IV is going to be 128 bits as well. Okay. Now, what if you choose the same IV twice just because of random chance? You're choosing this at random. What's the probability of that happening? Well, if it's 128 bits, it's 1 over 2 to the 128, and that's impossible. Like, you'll never end up choosing the same message twice. Yeah. Okay, so let's think about decryption, and then we'll let me give it to you in notation. Okay, so what we're talking about is the encryption in CBC mode. Okay, still going to take a key. Okay, I'll just do a dash. Okay. But now we have a new parameter. So instead of just taking the message, we're going to take this IV, and we're going to take the message, and it's going to return us a ciphertext, okay? And we're going to have a decryption function. Okay, and it's going to take the ciphertext. Okay, it's going to decrypt the message. Now, we got to figure out that whether we can actually decrypt or not. So I'm going to leave this open. Because the IV kind of is going to make decryption a little tricky, as we'll see, okay? So how do we actually decrypt this thing, okay? So what we want to do is we want to sort of reverse it. So all our ciphertexts will become messages and vice versa. Okay, these will become decryption functions instead of encryption functions. Okay, now let's just check and make sure that we got this the same. Okay, so to decrypt, let's just look at it backwards. So we have the ciphertext. The first thing it goes through is this function, but it has to go through it backwards. That's what a decryption function is. It's just the encryption function in reverse, okay? So we have the wrong order here, okay? So what we want to do is we want to swap the order in terms of these two elements. Then, if we start with this block, so we go through the decryption, then we're going to XOR it with the IV, okay? Now, this is a problem, because how does Bob know the IV? Okay, so let's punt on that for a second. We'll come back to that in a second. Okay, but assuming that, then we could get the message back, okay? Then, for the next one, okay, so ciphertext 2, if we want to get message 2 back here, what we're going to do is we're going to decrypt, so we'll reverse it. Then we're going to XOR it with this value here, this C value. Do we know this C value? We do know it, right? Because we're holding it in order to decrypt it. So it's going to look like this. Okay, so it's the same thing. It's basically sort of swapped or inverted, turned upside down. Okay? Now the final question is, okay, we kind of need the IV here. Okay? So if we have the IV, then we can definitely decrypt. Okay. So what does that look like? Well, we have Alice and we have Bob. So we're sending, you know, C, which is the ciphertext. Okay. But how does Bob end up with the same IV? Okay. They share the same key, K. Okay, so how do they end up with the same IV? So one answer might be, well, however they have the same key, they also have the same IV. So when they swap key material, they use the same IV. Now the problem with that is your IV changes with every encryption, your key doesn't change. Okay, you can use the same key as many times as you want. That's the guarantee of CPA security. But your ID, you have to have a new one. Okay, so you'd have to have a whole bunch of IDs. So that's not so great. Okay. Another thing we could do is we could just send the IV. Okay, so even if it's public, they need the key. So is this a big problem? What if we just send the IV in plain text so the adversary actually knows the IV? What does that actually bring?
The country could then use the same IV again.
Great, great. So think that through. So
we can use it to encrypt it again.
Okay, so what are we trying to prevent? We're trying to prevent the same encryption of the same message resulting in the same ciphertext. And the condition for that is now, in this case, look, first off, note that this is still deterministic, okay? This is deterministic. There's nothing non-deterministic about this itself, okay? The only non-deterministic element is IV, okay? It's a random number. So if IV and M are the same, C will be the same, okay? So all the adversary has to do to break this scheme the same way that they broke the same scheme is they need to be able to choose IV, essentially, okay? Now, the question is, who gets to choose it? So if the adversary sees C go across with one IV, okay, does that help them in predicting what the next IV is going to be? No, because Alice is choosing it, okay? So just because they can see the IV, it doesn't matter, okay? If Alice ever slipped up and used the same IV twice, right, then the adversary could see it, and then they could maybe mount an attack, okay? But other than that, there's no problem with actually revealing IV itself, okay? So IV is not a secret. And then going back to the earlier point, IV doesn't tell you anything about K, okay? If you know IV, you still have no idea what K is. So you still can't decrypt, okay? So think of IV as a public random value, okay? It's a random value. It's just meant to not use it twice. And then that's it, okay? I don't want to get too far ahead of myself. So it's now non-deterministic. It will be enough to get CPA secure, okay? So fact CBC, first off, I'll say CBC is OTP secure. OTS secure. Thank you. And CBC is CPA secure as well. Okay, and note that once you are CPA secure, inside this game is the OTS game. Okay, so if you can win this game with all the extra powers that you have, then you can win the game without the extra powers. So I said it backwards. If you can win the game, let's see. Yeah, sorry. Okay, so it's secure if you can't win the game, right? So if you can't win the game with all of these extra powers, then you're not going to win the game without those extra powers, okay? So if it's secure, even when you have extra powers, if I take your power away, then it's still going to be secure, okay? So in that case, anything that is CPA secure is also by definition OTS secure, okay? So once you have the highest level of definitions, you get the other ones for free. Question? Yeah. That's right, yeah. So why does the attack that we did on ECB, this attack, why doesn't it work on CBC mode? Okay, so the adversary asks for the encryption of M0 and M1, so they ask for A and B, okay, and they get back CB, which is the encryption of either A, B. Then they go and they say, give me an encryption of A, okay? Well, what happens is because the oracle is doing the encryption, the oracle is going to choose the IV. They're going to choose a different IV, okay? So what they'll do is they'll get back an encryption of A. Okay, sure. They'll get back an encryption of A. They'll know what the IV value was. Okay, but they have no idea what CB is because CB was encrypted under some different IV. Okay, so they don't know whether they have CA or not. Okay, and then they can keep asking. They can ask for 100 of encryptions of A, and every time they're going to get a different value of CA. Okay, they'll get a whole bunch. They'll have 100 values of CA. None of them are going to match or CB, even if CA was, even if A was the value that was chosen to be encrypted. Okay, so it's not going to help them at all. Okay, so that's why you can't break the game in the same way as soon as it's non-deterministic. So let's write that down.
So when you refer to ID, it's a pseudo-random.
Yeah, exactly. It's a random number. Okay. Yeah, or a pseudo-random number. Same way you select a key. Yeah. We can call it lemma. ECB attack doesn't work on CPA or on CBC, sorry. Okay, so every time you ask for an encryption of the same message, you get back a different ciphertext. So you're not going to break the game by virtue of inspecting ciphertext. Okay. Now, the final thing about IVs is, so IVs are not secret, as we said. But they can't be predictable either. What does predictable mean? So predictable, I mean, if something's not secret, it's predictable because you know what it is, right? So what do we mean by predictable? What we mean by predictable is that you don't know before encryption what the value is going to be, okay? So you have to settle on what you want encrypted, then the IV is chosen, okay? So message first, then IV. If you ever know what the IV is going to be ahead of time, you have a big problem. As designers of secure algorithms, you're going to have a big problem, okay? Okay, so predictable means that you can't know IV before choosing message. I'm writing really sloppy. Choosing quick. Yeah, so I'll give you an example. Okay, so what goes wrong? So let's say I come along and I say, okay, I want an encryption of A. So the adversary goes to the oracle and they say, give me encryption of message A. Okay, what happens? You guys sit down because I'll write better. Okay, so what the Oracle will do is they'll return an encryption of A. Okay, so this is, you can think of this as happening in the first half of the game. Okay, never mind. Okay, so in the first half of the game, we can ask for the encryption of anything we want. Okay, so we ask for the encryption of A. Okay, and we know if we can get them to encrypt the message A twice deterministically, then we can break the game. Okay, that's how we broke ECB. Okay, so you say, give me encryption of A. That's fine. The Oracle will send back an encryption of A. Okay, and the IV that they use. So we'll call it IV. And then you get C, which is the encryption under K of A. Okay, so we get back two values. Okay, now as a consequence of this, I'll just note it on the side. C is technically one block bigger than M. Okay, if you consider the IV as part of C as well. Okay, so now when you encrypt a message and it's five blocks long, you're actually sending six blocks across the wire, right? Your six C blocks plus your IV that you chose. Okay, so that's inconsequential, but it's good to keep in mind. Okay, so you say, give me encryption of A, and then it gets IV. Okay, now let's say that you know, okay, so the adversary somehow, they know the next IV value. Let's say they know it's going to be IV star, okay? So whatever, it's going to be 5. They just know because they're using a broken random number generator or whatever the reason is, okay? Somehow they know it, okay? The question is, can they get an encryption of A again under the same key and the same IV as they had up here, okay? So let's sort of reconsider. I'll draw it in a different color. Let's just remember what the diagram looks like. So we have this message A, and this is what's going to happen. Okay, what's going to happen is it's going to be XORed with IV star, okay? And then it's going to be put through the encryption function with some key. We have no idea what the key is, okay? And then we're going to get back C. Okay, so this is what we're expecting, okay? Now, what I'd like to do is I would like What I'd like to do is have an encryption of A under an IV that I choose. I'd like to have an encryption of A under the original IV. So it's deterministic. Okay. So is there any way to turn this into this? Okay, so we could try putting C up into the IV. In this case, it's going to go through the encryption function. It's going to get garbage out. But the way you're thinking is exactly correct. Okay, so what happens if we play around with A? So that's the only thing we can change, right? We have no control over what IV is going to come out as IV star, right? So we only have one input that we can control, which is A. Okay, so what could we send instead of A? Well, what if we said, let's send A XOR IV star? What happens? The IV cancels and we get A encrypted with C. What's that the same as? If the IVs cancel, what effectively is the IV that's being used? It is deterministic. Yep, so we did eliminate the IV, okay? But it is the same as A being encrypted under one specific value of an IV. All zeros, okay? So if our IV is all zeros, then this is the same as that, okay? Now, what if we want it to be the same as A encrypted under this IV? Okay, what if we do the following? What if we do this? Okay, so if we do A XOR IV star XOR IV, it gets XORed with IV star. IV star cancels out, right? So what's sitting on this wire here? What's sitting on this wire here is A XOR IV, okay? Now compare it to this scenario. In this scenario, you have A, IV is the IV here. So what's sitting on this wire here? AX or IV, okay, which is the same. And then the same thing goes through the same encryption function. It gives you the same output as C itself, okay? So how can we break the game knowing this, okay? So what we do is we say, give me encryption of A, and we get the IV that was used to encrypt A, okay? Then we go to the Oracle, okay, we're ready to play the game. Okay, so I'm going to give you my challenges. So I'm going to say one, for message one, or message zero, what is M0? I'm going to say, give me an encryption of A, XOR, IV, XOR, IV star, okay? And M1 will be whatever, something different, call it B, okay? And then what we'll do is we'll get back CB, okay? And what will the value of CB be? Well, CB is going to be exactly C if M0 was selected, okay? So if B equals 0, then it's going to encrypt this garbage under IV star. So IV star will cancel out, and so it will actually encrypt AX or IV, which is the same thing that it encrypted up here. It encrypted A under IV here. So we'll get back IV and C. And if B equals 1, we'll get, you know, something different. We'll get the same IV, and then we'll get some garbage-looking ciphertext. So, you know, like this. Okay. In fact, actually, we won't get the same IV. We'll just get some random IV. Okay. So, if we can predict what the IV is going to be ahead of time, then we can also break CPA security. Yeah, exactly, from true random seeds that you don't know, that no one knows except for your computer at a particular time. Yeah. Okay. And in practice, this is actually a real attack. So the HTTPS protocol, we'll talk about that like in the very last lecture. It's the thing that shows the little lock when you go to like Google or whatever, Gmail. Earlier versions of it, instead of generating IVs at random, what they would do is they would use the last ciphertext block that got sent. So you would send some traffic to Google, and whatever the last ciphertext was, you would use that as your next IV. Okay, they just did it as a sort of shortcut. You don't have to generate randomness all the time. The problem is that everyone knew what that value was going to be beforehand, because they would see that ciphertext block go by and they'd be like, okay, I know what the next IV is going to be, okay? And so it turned out that you could engineer an attack. Now, the attack was very like sophisticated. It was basically your computer kind of fighting itself, where you had a website where you had some JavaScript from a malicious place, and then it was trying to, say, get a password for like some site that it was actually embedded on. And so it was generating these blocks, and then you had to tap the wire. And anyways, it's a really involved attack in terms of actually making it practical. But it's real, okay? It was a real attack, and it all came down to the fact that IVs were not chosen at random, okay? So newer versions of TLS, 1.1, 1.2, they all fix this problem, and 1.3 will fix it as well. Okay, but this ended up actually being a particular attack.
Can you do this attack without playing it, like the first time you're playing the game? Or are you absolutely
need the previous message and the previous IV?
So you could do it the first time. That's a good question. Yeah, so I think if you knew the first IV, but then you didn't know any subsequent IV, that there's probably nothing you could do. I don't see a way you can break it. Okay, so CBC mode is CPA secure. Okay, now there's a second way of doing something that's CPA secure called counter mode. And so they're indistinguishable. You can use CBC or you can use counter. There's no difference in terms of security. They both have the same security level. So this is called CTR, or sometimes it's called CM for counter mode. You see different abbreviations. So in this case, we're also going to use an IV. What we're going to do is we're going to split our IV up. So the nonce won't be fully, so nonce is a fancy term for a random number. I should define that. Okay, so technically in CBC mode, you use a nonce as your IV. We don't use that terminology because, well, we have to distinguish the two because IVs aren't always random. Like in a hash function, it's just a fixed value, okay? So IVs can look any different way. IV just means that first value when you don't have a previous block to pump in, okay? So in CBC mode, it's called a nonce. The whole thing is a nonce. In counter mode, half of it will be a nonce, and then the rest of it will be, as the name implies, a counter. So a counter is just, you know, what it sounds like. You first time you do it, you make it 0, then you make it 1, then you make it 2, all the way up. Okay, and it doesn't really matter your split. For it to be unpredictable, remember this it's not a secret. So the IV, everyone will know the value of the IV. So it doesn't have to be unexhaustively searchable. So it doesn't have to be like 112 bits or anything like that. It just has to be unpredictable in the sense that if you guess what it's going to be ahead of time, the probability that you guess correctly is going to be really, really low. Okay. So if we make this like 64 bits and 64 bits for AES 128, then that's fine. You have a 1/2 to the 64 chance of getting the nonce correct, which is so small that it doesn't matter. And the counter will go to 2^64 values, which would take you, you know, years and years and years to actually go all the way through. That's not exactly true. But anyways, yeah, a computer, one single computer that wasn't optimized with a GPU or something like that, it would probably take on the order of years to go through all the values, but you can change your knots anytime you want, okay? So these are two big numbers that you're never going to use more than once. Okay, so how do we do it? So what we do is we take our IV and we put it through our encryption function. Then we take our first block of our message and we XOR it in with the output. And this gives us a ciphertext as a result. Okay. Then what we do is we increment the counter, which I'll just denote this way, in the IV. Okay. So we start with random number 579396, whatever. It's actually in binary, so 01000111, and then our counter is 00000, okay? Then we use the exact same value. The only bit that changes is at the very end. The counter will be 00001, okay? Then we'll take that value, and we'll put it through the encryption function again, and then we'll take our next block of message, and we'll XOR it in, and then we'll repeat it. Okay, and so this is the encryption scheme.
For the next encryption, but the counter stays the same, or does it go back to 0?
So the next time you'll choose a new nonce and you'll put your counter back to 0. Yeah. Okay, So what do we actually output here? So once again, we're going to send the IV as well. So we'll send the ciphertext and the IV. That would be the encryption in counter mode under key K of some message and some IV. Okay. And then the decryption should work. Yeah, just give me one sec. Okay, yeah.
Counter is 64-bit, right?
So it could be, yeah.
So it keeps increasing with every block.
That's right, yeah. So eventually it will run out, you'll wrap back, but it's 2 to the 64 blocks, which is just an obscene amount of data, like more than, yeah, all the computers in the room could hold. Okay, so this is what encryption looks like. Okay, first off, what does decryption look like? Does anyone want to take a stab? So can we reverse this process? All right, so we're going to take C. We're going to kind of go backwards. So we're going to XOR it. Well, we don't know what M is, right? So what do we XOR C with to get M? Well, this value, the value that's sitting on this wire right here, okay? So whatever value is sitting here, if we XOR this and C, we'll get back M, right? M XOR this value gave us C. C XOR this value will give us M, okay? So what is the value that's sitting here? IV encrypted, okay? So what happens is actually very strange in counter mode, and this is actually considered a feature instead of a bug, is when you want to decrypt, you sort of reverse it. So you take your ciphertext in, okay, and you will get your message out. And note that when you're decrypting, you're actually using the encryption function. So when you decrypt, you're not actually using the decryption function itself, okay? You're reusing the encryption function, okay? So one of the nice things about counter mode is, I'll just note some differences. You only need an encryption function, okay? So it saves you a little bit of space. So if you have a chip that's implementing block ciphers, you don't have to have both the encryption and the decryption algorithm. You just need the encryption algorithm, okay? Now, because decryption is an exact reversal of encryption, the two circuits look exactly the same. So we haven't seen what it actually looks like on the inside. I'll show you AES. But they basically work exactly the same thing. You're just sort of doing things in reverse order. So it's not a huge savings, but that's one particular saving, okay? Now, the second thing I would note is, okay, what does this look like? What can we say about this value that's sitting here? So it's an encrypted value. What do we know about the output of an encryption function? What does it look like? Looks like random, okay? So we kind of have like a random number that's sitting here, okay? Now here, we have the exact same input. It only differs by one bit, right? This is ends in zero and this ends in one. What can we say about this value here? It's also random. And how does it compare to this first value? Completely different, right? It's as if it doesn't matter if this completely changed or if it only complete or if it only changes by one bit. You're always going to get some completely random output. Why is that? Because of the avalanche effect. Okay. So if we encrypt this, we get a random output, and then we get a different random output, and then a different random output. So what we really have is a bunch of randomness that's coming out of this pink box. It's being XORed with our message to give us our ciphertext. What does that sound like? So what we have is a bunch of randomness coming out of our pink box. If you just draw a box around the pink box and say, who cares what's inside of it, all you're seeing is a bunch of randomness come out. So no. Okay, first off, if I give you a box and say this thing spits out randomness, what is that? So what's a box that spits out randomness? A PRG, okay? So PRG, you can think of the K as the seed, okay? So that's what that pink box is. It's a PRG. It actually is exactly a PRG, okay? It's something that takes a seed, K, and it spits out randomness, okay? So now we have our PRG. It's spitting out randomness. We're X-orient with our message. What's that? Extractor, hash, one-time function, one-time pad, stream cipher, okay? You all know this by next week, I promise. Okay, that's a stream cipher. A stream cipher is a PRG XORed with your message, gives you your ciphertext, okay? So this counter mode is a stream cipher, okay? It's a stream cipher that happens to use a block cipher as the PRG, okay? So that's where the PRG comes from. It just uses a block. So a block cipher in counter mode is a PRG, and counter mode is a stream cipher. Okay, so it's exactly the same as a stream cipher. So this is, you can use this as a PRG. So if you need a PRG, instead of using ChaCha20, you can just, if you have a block cipher already, then you can use it in counter mode, and then that's a PRG. Yeah. So the nonce will change every time you encrypt a new message. So it depends on the protocol itself. So in TLS, like for example, every time, like you send some stuff to Google, they send a response back, then next time you would change the nonce again and then send it back. Yeah. Other questions? Okay. All right, so this is counter mode. Let's see. Okay, another thing about counter mode is all of these things, all of your outputs of your pink box, you don't have to see the message before you start to generate them, okay? So the most expensive thing, if we think of a performance, the most expensive thing is this encryption box. It's expensive, and XOR is really cheap, one clock cycle, okay? Now, these boxes you can do in a clock cycle now on modern architectures, but the point is you could pre-compute what all these values are, so they're just sitting there. Then when your data starts coming in, you can do the XOR, okay? In CBC, you can't do that. In CBC, you have to wait to see. So let's go down to the decryption. You have to get the C before you can start doing anything with it, okay? So until you have the C and you're holding it in your hand, you have nothing to decrypt, okay? So there's no way to do any kind of pre-computation in terms of CBC, okay? You see your data first, then you can decrypt, okay? But here... So this is the decryption algorithm. You can pre-compute all these EKs, so you have these values, they're all sitting there. Then when your Cs come in, it's just one XOR away from decryption. Okay. So counter allows encryption operations to be pre-computed. That's right. Yeah. So before you see ciphertext, now in this case, you do have to know the IV though ahead of time. So this works in scenarios where you're receiving some data, then you receive data later with the same IV, and then you receive data later with the same IV. So you're not reseeding the IV every single time. Now, another thing in CBC mode, if you want to sort of retort, what CBC mode can do is they can parallelize decryption, okay? So if you're working on this block, for example, let's say you want to decrypt this third block, do you have to have the decryptions of the first two blocks to decrypt this third block? No, you don't, right? Because this is only dependent on this ciphertext plus the previous ciphertext, okay? So once you hold all the ciphertexts in hand, if you have 50 GPUs, you can give each, you have to give it basically say, okay, I want you to decrypt this one, here's the previous block, and then it's able to compute that particular value, okay? So in CBC, you can parallelize it. So counter mode's still better because you can just pre-compute it, but in CBC, you can. You can parallelize the decryption. So there are other modes of operations that look, I'm just showing you the most common ones, things that show up in TLS, but there's a million variants on this that look almost the same, but like they'll take the value before it goes through the encryption function and feed it forward, or they feed different things forward in different ways, and they all end up being basically roughly secure. But the only difference is in terms of its actual performance. So this idea that you can parallelize CBC decryption is a sort of advantage.
Is it more convenient to pre-compute?
So pre-computation is probably better, but yeah. Okay, then the last thing I want to talk about is what we call malleability, which we've seen before. So we saw length extension attacks when we were talking about hash functions. We saw malleability problems. We saw with stream ciphers a particular malleability. Okay. Now, because counter mode is a stream cipher, we could just jump in there. So let's say that I have a ciphertext. Okay. And I'm going to do counter mode on it. So I'm not going to draw out the whole circuit, but we'll just say this is counter mode decryption. So I'm going to get back my message. Okay. Now, let's say I'm the adversary and I'm on the wire and I see this go by and I'm like, hey, you know what? I'm going to flip this bit of the ciphertext. Okay, so if it's a 1, I'm going to turn it into 0, or if it's a 0, I'm going to turn it into a 1. Okay. What happens to the message when you decrypt? What does it look like? So it's going to change. So what's it actually going to change? Okay, is it going to, so it could change the whole thing. By whole thing, we mean 1, 2, 3. We mean 2 and then fed forward to 3. Okay, so remember, this is counter. So I started with counter first. So let's look at the actual decryption. Okay, so what we're saying is we're flipping a bit in this here. So first off, if a bit gets flipped here, is it going to have any influence on either of the two values on either side of it? No, because everything's siloed off. Okay. So it, at most, it can only affect this one, okay? Now, what we're doing is we're flipping a bit and we're XORing it in to the same value. So what's the result going to be?
1 bit change.
1 bit change, okay? So just like a stream cipher, right? In a stream cipher, if you flip a bit of the ciphertext, the corresponding bit of the message flips. Counter mode is a stream cipher. It has the same property, okay? So you can stare at the diagram and make sure you understand this, but what's going to result is the same bit is going to get flipped, and then the rest of it's going to be exactly the same. Okay? Now, what about CBC? So CBC is going to be a little harder. So let me copy-paste it, and then I'll Then I'll show you the diagram because you won't get it unless if you're probably staring at the diagram. Okay, so in CBC mode, let's go back and look at the diagram. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to flip, say, this bit. So what's going to happen? Okay, so let's, first off, if flipping a bit here, is it going to have any influence on this value?
No.
Okay. Okay. But we have this, like, forward chaining, so we have some potential in terms of it affecting future values. Okay, so let's say we flip this bit. Okay, so the first thing is, in terms of this message, it's going to go through the decryption function. What's going to happen to the output here?
Totally different.
Totally different. Garbage. Okay, it's going to get XORed with some previous thing. This block is going to be completely ruined. Okay? Now, what about this block? Well, this block depends on the decryption of this, but this is the same. We didn't change this. Okay? So the value sitting here is the same. That didn't change. Okay? But the XOR that we pulled here has a bit flipped.
One bit. Yeah.
So one bit's going to flip here, okay? Then what's going to happen in the next block, even though we don't have it drawn? Okay, so I should have drawn it. So let's actually back up and go here. Pretend the bit flip is here, okay? So this block gets ruined, right? This block gets forward, and so we have the one bit flip here, just like a stream cipher. Okay? What about this one?
Nothing.
Okay, there's no influence. This block never touches this block. Okay? All right. So that's the output of CBC. So, yeah, it would be better if I had four, so let me just quickly change it.
So CTR is better because we only have one bit.
So, well, let's think about, yeah, what we think is better or worse. Okay, so we'll put our bit flip here. Okay, so what's going to happen? It's going to flip this, or sorry, it's going to ruin this entire block. Okay, so this entire block will get ruined. And it's going to flip this bit here. And there's going to be no consequence here and no consequence to the previous block either. Okay, which one's better or worse? Well, this one's kind of worse because you actually have very fine-grained control, okay? But in this one, it's still pretty consequential. You still have some control over what you want to see. So if you see this message go by and you don't know what it is, like it's an encryption of your salary, that's the example we always use, well, you can kind of start flipping things and have things flip down here. You're going to ruin some stuff, so your chances of it actually being a meaningful change are somewhat diminished. But we really don't like this as cryptographers. Okay, we don't want you to be able to do anything to the ciphertext and have an idea of what's going to happen as a consequence. Okay, we want it that if you flip one bit of the ciphertext, either, you know, it completely ruins the message. Okay, so you have no control over it, or even better yet, it would just like throw an error and say that's not a valid ciphertext. That would be really great if we could do that. Okay. And so that's where we're going. So we have these two security games. So we have one-time secure and then CBC, okay? What we want is, or sorry, CPA, thank you. What we want is a third level of security. It's going to be called CCA, Chosen Ciphertext Security, okay? And what it's going to do is it's going to eliminate all these malleability attacks. So if there's any way to do a malleability attack on the encryption scheme, it will not be CCA secure. Okay, so you can turn any malleability feature you have, no matter how weird it is in terms of what it ruins and what it doesn't ruin, you can turn that into an attack on, you can turn it into an attack on any CPA secure encryption, if you have a malleability attack for your mode of operation, you can always win the CCA game on that mode of operation. Therefore, that mode of operation will never be CCA secure. Okay? So anyway, that's a roadmap. It doesn't make much sense now, but that's where we're going to go. So we're going to tweak the game again. We're going to give the adversary even more power, and now they're going to have so much power that if you have any kind of malleability problems, it's never going to pass that particular game. Then we'll come up with a new mode of operation that is secure against these malleability attacks. Okay? Anyways, all that's going to be in like 2 weeks after the midterm. Yeah, any quick questions about this? Yeah. Sorry, today's lecture is covered on the midterm. Yeah. Yeah, sure. So I can try and put it up tonight before I go to bed. Okay, yeah, quick. Okay, let's take it offline. And then, yeah. Okay, thanks everyone. Good luck on the midterm. Yeah. Yeah. As a block of the message.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Hey. So,